So our passage this evening is 2 Kings 22, verse 1, through to chapter 23, verse 30, the theme of which is the reign of King Josiah. Josiah, king of Judah, that is. And the reign of Josiah is relatively long, and it is in many ways a high point of this bleak book. But you can perhaps tell, even just by my tone of voice there, that there's a but coming. Yes, this reign is righteous and God-honoring and idol-intolerant and therefore deeply encouraging and refreshing, but this reign also takes place in the shadow of something dreadful that is looming on the horizon. It was announced, you may remember, in chapter 21, during the abhorrent reign of Josiah's grandfather Manasseh, Yahweh sent prophets with this message, chapter 21, verse 12. Behold, I am bringing upon Jerusalem and Judah such disaster that the ears of everyone who hears of it will tingle. And I will stretch over Jerusalem the measuring line of Samaria and the plumb line of the house of Ahab. And I will wipe Jerusalem as one wipes a dish, wiping it and turning it upside down. And I will forsake the remnant of my heritage and give them into the hand of their enemies. And they shall become a prey and a spoil to all their enemies, because they have done what is evil in my sight and have provoked me to anger since the day their fathers came out of Egypt, even to this day. So it was announced then, and now in this passage, despite its generally happy and positive tone, there are repeated reminders of the impending calamity. And three times in the Josiah narrative, a particular word is used to describe it, to describe the storm that is coming Judah's way. It's the word wrath. Wrath. Josiah speaks of the wrath of Yahweh, chapter 22, verse 13. Yahweh himself, through Huldah the prophetess, speaks of my wrath, chapter 22, verse 17. And the narrator speaks of Yahweh's great wrath, chapter 23, verse 26. It's like a drumbeat. Wrath, wrath, wrath. You can't miss it. You can't pretend that this passage is solely a story of reformation and renewal and lovely things like that. Not when we keep being hit over the head with this five-letter word, wrath. No, the fact of the matter is, an honest study of King Josiah has to relate this man to this theme. It has to relate him to the wrath of God that is so unmistakably on its way. And so that's what our study of King Josiah this evening is going to do. And there are three main points then that I want to make. And first of all this, Josiah is privileged to escape God's wrath. That's the first thing I want us to notice. Josiah is privileged to escape God's wrath. Let's dive for a moment into one scene within this long passage. It's the scene in which Josiah sends his representatives to this woman, Huldah, who's a prophetess. He sends them in order to receive from her a divine message. And he does receive from her a divine message. A divine message which is initially very dark, reaffirming chapter 22, verses 16 and 17, what the relatively near future holds for Judah. As I've already said, it's in Yahweh's message through Huldah that we have one of the occurrences of that word wrath. But a divine message which, following that dark introduction, then changes its tone. Because chapter 22, verses 18 to 20, aren't about Judah anymore. They are about Josiah. And Josiah, this message through Huldah, announces, isn't going to experience the coming wrath. His eyes, verse 20, shall not see all the disaster that I will bring upon this place. But the message through Huldah doesn't just announce that, it also explains it. It gives in verse 19 the reason. Notice in the middle of that verse, Yahweh says to Josiah, "You heard how I spoke against this place and against its inhabitants, that they should become a desolation and a curse." You heard that. Now that refers back to what has happened earlier in the chapter. You probably picked up the sequence of events during the reading. It goes like this. Josiah instigates some repairs to the temple building. That seems to trigger the discovery in the temple of the book of the law, that is the law of Moses. Having been discovered, the law is then read to the king. As he listens to it being read, he hears, of course, many things, including its dire threats of punishment should its stipulations be disobeyed. And that then is what Yahweh's message through Huldah here is talking about in verse 19. When he says, "You have heard how I spoke against this place and against its inhabitants, that they should become a desolation and a curse," he means you have heard it as the law of Moses was being read out in your hearing. But there's more. Josiah's hearing from that law about the punishment that God must send on his disobedient people, that in itself actually isn't the key thing. That isn't the reason that his eyes aren't going to see the coming disaster. No, it's how Josiah responds to what he hears in the law. That's the thing. Look at the first part of verse 19. "Because your heart was penitent, and you humbled yourself before the Lord when you heard how I spoke against this place," and so on. The word translated penitent there is really just soft. Josiah responded to the law's damning indictment of Judah, not by being defensive and indignant, not by drowning it out with claims of success in this area and success in that area. That would have been a hard-hearted and proud response. Rather, he sorrowfully accepted the devastating rightness of the law's accusations. That's what it means that he was soft-hearted and self-humbling. And it's because of that response then, because of Josiah's softness of heart and humility, that he's not going to see the coming wrath. He's going to escape God's wrath. Now, you will have heard that idea bandied about, no doubt, that God's wrath is just an Old Testament theme. In the New Testament, it pretty much recedes out of sight. Anyone who says that has either never read the New Testament or is simply lying, because the wrath of God remains very much in view in the New Testament scriptures. Let me just mention one text. Romans chapter 2, verse 5. There the Apostle Paul speaks of the day of wrath. The day of wrath, when God's righteous judgment will be revealed, he says. He means at the end of time. Then there is going to occur, he says, a day of wrath. I found out recently that there's such a thing as World Spider Day. It takes place sometime in March, I believe. Think of that. It's bad enough having to confront the reality of spiders in a fleeting way every now and again when one scurries across your kitchen floor. But a whole day taken up with spiders. No, thank you. But Paul is talking in Romans 2:5 about something infinitely, 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 infinitely more terrible. A world wrath day. A day that's coming that will be taken up with the wrath of God. That is a truly horrific prospect. But you know, it's possible to escape God's wrath. To escape the wrath that is going to be poured out on that day. To escape it, we need the same softness of heart and humility which Josiah displayed. Not that softness of heart and humility are the ground of the escape from God's wrath. They don't earn or merit this escape I'm talking about. No, we'll come to what the ground of the escape from God's wrath is later. But while not the ground, they are required of all who escape God's wrath. No one escapes God's wrath without this softness of heart and humility. And so let me ask, are those characteristics discernible in you this evening? I'm talking about a frank acknowledgement that yes, you're a sinner, entitled to nothing from God, ripe for his wrath. That is Josiah-like softness of heart and humility. The natural default human position is to be offended at the whole notion of deserving God's wrath. That's what you'll find in people in your workplaces and in your neighborhoods and generally in our society. But the one who is Josiah-like says, I deserve God's wrath. I wish it were not so. I wish I'd served my Maker as he is worthy of being served, but I haven't, and I don't have a leg to stand on. It's that broken and contrite heart of which we just sang a few minutes ago in Psalm 51. It's that being poor in spirit of which our Lord spoke in his Sermon on the Mount. And such a person, I'm saying, escapes God's wrath, the wrath that is coming on the last day. You know, there's nothing better than for that to be true of you. There's nothing better than to be able to say, there's going to be no wrath for me on the day of wrath that is coming. There really is nothing better than that. I'm fascinated by chapter 22, verse 20, where part of Huldah's happier words to Josiah then are these: you shall be gathered to your grave in peace. I wonder, is that how you would describe the way that Josiah dies at the end of our passage? It doesn't seem a particularly pretty and pleasant way that he dies. He goes out to this battle, probably ill-advised. Chronicles certainly seems to imply that or state that, really. He goes out to this battle with the king of Egypt. The king of Egypt takes one look at him and kills him. And he's carried back to Jerusalem in a chariot, dead. Is that dying in peace? Well, compared to what's coming Judah's way when God's wrath is outpoured, presumably, yes, it is. That is dying in peace. That's nothing. That's child's play compared to what is coming the day God's wrath is poured out on the land. And it's why then you encounter Christians, as I'm sure you all have, you encounter Christians suffering terrible things and yet doing so with remarkable patience and composure and even sometimes we can say contentment. It might be cancer, it might be bereavement, it might be poverty, all sorts of things. I'm not talking about some stoical thing, no tears, no crying out, no moments of inner darkness. Of course, there will always be those. But you do encounter Christians. We have seen Christians in our own congregation whose overall demeanor in the face of grievous suffering has been quite extraordinary. How come? Well, because they know that compared with the outpouring of God's wrath on that last day, this suffering is, relatively speaking, small. And they are not going to experience that outpouring of God's wrath on the last day. And they can cope then with the lesser calamity of temporal suffering because the great calamity of God's wrath is off the table. And again, I ask you then this evening, are you one of those? Are you one of those with Josiah-like softness of heart and humility? One of those who has frankly acknowledged you're a sinner without one plea. Are you one of those Josiah-like, soft-hearted ones set to escape the coming wrath of God? So that's the first thing then. Josiah is privileged to escape God's wrath. Notice secondly, Josiah is passionate to express God's wrath. Josiah is passionate to express God's wrath. So in chapter 23, verses 4 to 20, we have what the ESV calls in its heading above the chapter, Josiah's reforms. And these reforms then, which Josiah carries out in these verses, they are rigorous in the extreme. We won't trawl through all the details just now, but notice then that a lot of breaking goes on here. Verse 7, he broke down the houses of the male cult prostitutes. Verse 8, he broke down the high places of the gate that were at the entrance of the gate. Verse 12, he pulled down and broke in pieces the altars on the roof of the upper chamber of Ahaz. Verse 14, he broke in pieces the pillars and cut down the Asherim. Verse 15, he pulled down this altar at Bethel. There's all this breaking going on. Then again, there's a lot of defiling goes on as Josiah carries out his reforms. Verse 8, he defiled the high places where the priests have made offerings. Verse 10, he defiled Topheth, which is where these child sacrifices had taken place. Verse 13, he defiled the high places east of Jerusalem. Verse 16, he defiled the tombs on this mount. It's the idea of making these sites so patently disgusting that no one would ever dream of using them again for religious activity. You'd never dream of building a theme park at Chernobyl. You'd never dream of building a housing estate at Auschwitz, because those places are just off limits for such things. And that's what Josiah is making these sites. That's what it means, this language of defiling them. He's not just knocking down the present iterations of altars and idols, but he's making sure that no further iterations of them will ever reappear. And not only then is there a lot of breaking going on and a lot of defiling going on, there's even some killing going on in Josiah's reforms. Verse 20, he sacrificed all the priests of the high places. And of course, he does all this then not just in Judah, where you'd expect him to be at work, but he even goes into Israel. Israel, of course, is now no longer inhabited by Israelites. Remember, the Israelites have been carried away by the Assyrians, and the land has been repopulated with others, to some extent at least. And yet, Josiah isn't content to confine his reforms just to Judah. He goes off northwards to Israel and breaks and defiles and does all this stuff there as well. And so these are extremely rigorous reforms, I'm saying, that we see this man carrying out. I think we can detect that he's angry. We can detect wrath. It's not in some dispassionate spirit that you go around smashing things to pieces. No, we can detect real wrath in Josiah as he rampages through Judah and even into Israel, smashing things, pulling things down, and all the rest of it. Indeed, there's another verb that's used several times in this passage that is particularly telling. Not only is there a lot of breaking and a lot of defiling and a bit of killing going on, but there's a lot of burning also goes on. Verse 4, he burned the Baal and Asherah and the host of heaven. In verse 6, we have him there burning the Asherah. And in verse 11, we have him burning the chariots of the sun with fire. In verse 15, we have him burning an altar and burning an Asherah. And in verse 16, we have him burning bones. And in verse 20, we have him again burning bones. And that's interesting then, all these references to burning, because The three God's wrath references, remember I said right at the start, there are these three references in our passage to God's wrath. Well, those three God's wrath references, they all use fire-related language. Kindled, that's used in all three of those references to God's wrath in our passage. Not quenched, that's used in chapter 22, verse 17. Burning, that's used in chapter 23, verse 26. The Lord did not turn from the burning of his great wrath. And I think then we can say of Josiah that not only is there wrath in this man as he carries out these reforms, but I think we can go further and say there's a sharing in God's wrath as he carries out these reforms. I'm saying this link between the burning wrath of God and Josiah's wrath, which causes a lot of burning to take place, I think that is suggestive. I think it's saying to us that there is a link between Josiah's wrath and God's wrath here. Josiah, in his wrath, is expressing something of God's wrath. He's sharing in it. He's reflecting it. I think we're meant to infer that. God's wrath is going to be poured out on Judah, of course, on a massive, far-reaching scale. Look at verse 27 of chapter 23. I will remove Judah out of my sight as I have removed Israel. I will cast off this city. God's wrath is going to be poured out on Judah on a massive, far-reaching scale, albeit in a much more narrowly focused way, however. Josiah, I'm saying, is expressing something of the same wrath. And we need to ask the question then, in the light of that, is that concept of any relevance at all to us, New Covenant believers, to us Christians? This concept of sharing in and expressing something of God's wrath. Should we think in those terms? Should we speak in those terms? Should that be a thing for us Christians? Well, we do need to handle this with great care. Not least because of the incalculable importance of gentleness within the Christian life. Remember I preached a few weeks ago, I think it was around Christmas time, on Galatians chapter 6, and the end of chapter 5 and the beginning of chapter 6, where Paul, do you remember, has that striking a title for the Holy Spirit, the Spirit of Gentleness. And I talked then about how gentleness, of course, necessarily is part of the fruit of the Spirit in us. If he's the Spirit of Gentleness, then gentleness is going to be part of his fruit in our lives. And remember, Paul, in that passage we were looking at, talks about when you're restoring someone who has fallen into sin, a brother or sister, do it with great gentleness. So gentleness, I stressed that evening, is of incalculable importance in the Christian life. There shouldn't be such a thing as a non-gentle Christian. It's a complete contradiction in terms. It's intrinsic to being a Christian that you are gentle. And so that means we must handle what I'm saying now with enormous care. But having said that, there is a place, is there not, for sharing and reflecting and expressing God's wrath. That is being angry with those things which anger God. Things like defiant, unrepentant wickedness, the promotion of that which is utterly perverse, the exploitation of defenseless victims, shameless hypocrisy. When we see these things in society, when we see these things in the church, when we see the germ of these things in our own hearts, should anger not be at least part of our response? Martin Lloyd-Jones speaks very helpfully and very strikingly about this theme. He's commenting on Ephesians chapter 4, verse 19, where Paul uses an interesting word to describe the unbelieving Gentile world. In the ESV, it's translated callous. He describes the unbelieving Gentile world as callous. It's literally something like dead to feeling. That's what he's getting at, dead to feeling. This is what Lloyd-Jones says. He says, they, that is, these unbelieving Gentiles of whom Paul speaks, they had become morally indifferent. They had become supine. This is always a characteristic of godlessness and irreligion. It is one of the terrible aspects of paganism that men and women become so steeped in sin that they are not aware of the fact that they are sinning. They cannot react at all. They never feel any sense of indignation or horror. They never become angry at all. They are past feeling. He continues, Paul therefore says to the Ephesian Christians, you are to get right away from the world's sins. You've got to learn to be angry about them. You must be roused. You must not be complacent and say that sin does not matter. Such an attitude belonged to their past, he said, but they must not be like that any longer. A failure to react with indignation and anger against sin and evil is always a sign of moral decadence and of godlessness and irreligion. Be angry, he concludes. Rouse yourselves. Do not allow yourselves to be governed by that old mentality. Put off that old man. Put on the new man. We must learn, says Paul, to be really angry against iniquity and sin. God made us in such a way that that should be our natural reaction. It is God's reaction to sin. And so, as I say, I don't want for one moment to undermine anything I said a few weeks ago, preaching on Galatians and the immense importance of gentleness. That is non-negotiable. But nonetheless, there is a place for feeling something of God's own anger against egregious sin, wickedness. And there is a danger of us becoming callous, becoming dead to feeling, of us becoming apathetic and blithe in the face of that which is horrendous. May we be those who, like Josiah here, are passionate to express God's wrath. So we're relating then Josiah to this prominent theme in our passage of God's wrath, and we've said in the first place Josiah is privileged to escape God's wrath. We've said secondly, Josiah is passionate to express God's wrath. But then thirdly and finally, Josiah is powerless to end God's wrath. Josiah is powerless to end God's wrath. So Josiah can do an awful lot. He does do an awful lot throughout this long reign of his. He changes the religious and ethical landscape of Judah. He even, as we've said, penetrates beyond Judah to Israel. He accomplishes an awful lot, and we're impressed, aren't we, as we read all that he does. We're impressed at the energy of this man, the passion of this man. But then we come to chapter 23, verse 26, and it kind of brings us down to earth with a bump. Still, the narrator says, still the Lord did not turn from the burning of his great wrath by which his anger was kindled against Judah. He can do an awful lot, but he can't change that. He can't end God's wrath against the people. He can escape God's wrath himself. We talked about that in our first point. But he cannot end God's wrath for a whole people. Josiah steps onto the stage of history, remains on it for several decades, steps off the stage of history. God's wrath is still hanging over the people of Judah. That's one thing he can't do. He can bang things down. He can go around smashing things, uprooting things, defiling things, burning things. He can do ever so much, but he cannot end God's wrath for a whole people. In that connection, verses 21 to 23 of chapter 23 are quite interesting. There we read that one of these reforms, one of these things that he instigated was the recovery of Passover. And of course, the whole thing about the Passover was that it reminded Israel of one occasion when God's wrath was ended for a whole people through those sacrificial lambs. God's wrath was hanging over all Israel as well as all Egypt there at that time. But lambs were sacrificed, and that ended God's wrath against that entire people. And instead of being consumed by God's wrath, out of Egypt they came. And the great story then, just stepping back, the great story of the Bible is that God has a people that he chose before the foundation of the world. And wonderfully, his wrath toward that people has ended. And it has ended because 2 millennia ago, he sent into the world a descendant of Josiah's, but not to be a mere reformer like his ancestor. Reformers are good, but they're ultimately very limited in their scope. No, God sent this descendant of Josiah not to be a reformer, but to be a lamb, to be a sacrificial lamb. I said earlier that softness of heart and humility are required of all who escape God's wrath, but they are not the ground of the escape from God's wrath. This is the ground of the escape. This lamb sacrificed on Calvary's cross 2,000 years ago. And I just close then by saying that if you're a member tonight of God's people, that elect people of God, rejoice in the Lamb. Rejoice you don't just have a reformer tonight who went about pulling things down. That's exciting to read about. That's dramatic to watch. But it couldn't end God's wrath against the elect. But rejoice there's a Lamb, this Jesus. And he shed his blood, and that did what no reformer could do. It did what no other hero in the whole canon of the Bible could do. For all their goodness, for all their righteousness, for all their reformations, the sacrifice that Jesus carried out on Calvary's cross did what none of that could ever do in a million years. It ended God's wrath against a multitude no man can number. If you're part of that multitude tonight, rejoice in the Lamb. Heaven is rejoicing tonight in the Lamb. Worthy is the Lamb, it's crying. The Passover Lamb, the Passover Lamb. Good Friday's Passover Lamb. Thank God with all your heart that there is a Lamb who by his own blood has ended for all God's people the wrath that is so deserved. Amen. Well, let's close singing number 695.